You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Looking at Boeing, the stock's down about 0.3%, but we've got a good, better sense of kind of their first quarter deliveries. The lowest since mid-2021, so not good. Although, as you read into it, the company delivered 27 aircraft in March, and that's a slight improvement from the 27 delivered in January and February. But again, the combination, and all the majority of these things were the 737 MAX jets. That's what we mostly, I think most of us fly these days, the 737 MAX.
Well, when I
I'm a Boeing person. I mean, I'm a United customer out of Newark,
right.
And United flies the Boeing planes. And I report to George every time I get on a plane to go anywhere, I report to him what the aircraft I'm on, the quality of it, how full it is. So I give him some of that primary research. George Ferguson joins us. He covers the airlines, the aerospace companies. Is the first quarter here, is this going to be the bottom, George, for Boeing in terms of deliveries?
I think, yeah, for the year, I think this is going to be the bottom. So I'd expect this was the worst quarter. You know, the FAA was in there doing their review of Boeing's manufacturing. Boeing's got to come up for a plan for the FAA. I imagine that takes some hands as well. And manufacturing probably isn't moving very fast while they're in the middle of this process of figuring out how to stabilize, the production of the airplanes. And so I think this will be the worst quarter, and I would expect that things would get better second, third, and fourth into the end of the year.
George, really nice to see you. We decided that we've maybe met twice after all this time.
We have some research people in Princeton,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they prefer the Princeton
right,
office
right,
as opposed to coming to the world's financial hub, center of it all.
Traffic.
Prefer Princeton.
I mean, I get it.
So we offer the option.
Yeah, it's fun to be here.
That's how we do that.
There's a couple ways to break it down, so let's just take it maybe piece by piece. First of all, supply chain stuff that like Boeing will be a part of and Airbus will be a part of too. Like, how is the supply chain impacting their deliveries?
Well, I mean, right now, I think the biggest problem is up at Boeing and not in the supply chain.
So supply chain stuff is fixed?
No, not at all. Okay. So I meant for the number of deliveries we've seen this quarter and the constriction in that number of deliveries, this is all Boeing issue, right? This is all Boeing's FAA review, their manufacturing review. Their supply chain, I think, is producing at a higher rate than they are right now. So Spirit AeroSystems would be an important part of their supply chain. They're building somewhere around 38, or they were building around 38, 737 maxes a month when we heard from them at the end of the year, you know, for their 4Q earnings call. We understand from Spirit that their suppliers were even building at higher rates than them in some cases, maybe even up at sort of 42 numbers. And they're already thinking about Spirit moving to a 42 number for the MAX. Again, we're talking MAX, which is the highest volume airplane. They were talking about Spirit moving to a 42 number just prior to the Alaska, door panel incident. And that's when everything sort of hit the skids. But I think most of it hit the skids up at Boeing, which has to manage all the FAA, inquiries and their manufacturing review.
All right, George, on Thursday, I am flying from Newark to Durham, North Carolina on a Boeing 737 MAX 8 plane. I will report into you. You can express that primary research. What's that?
You're off Friday?
I'm off Friday.
Bummer.
Yep.
Right. Tucker, I love you too. Just, you know. Bummer.
She could care less.
Not true at all. Okay.
George, if I guess if I'm in the company, I don't want to go too fast. I think I, you know, I can't have any more mishaps here. So it's almost like if I'm an investor, I'm not sure I'm knocking on the door saying, hey, you guys got to get back to 38 or 40. Kind of do it when you can kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, do it when you can. But in the long-term interest of Boeing, they have to increase build rates here. And, okay. and that's going to drive better cash flow and better profits.
That's, okay.
I mean, look, their competitor across the Atlantic, right, which has, by the way, has final assembly facilities all around the world, including one in Mobile, Alabama.
So really? Yeah, Airbus has a thing in Mobile?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
I didn't know that.
But their competitor is operating up in the 45 range per month for their A320, the major competitor. If Boeing wants to be in this business long term, they have to stabilize production. You're right, but they've got to stabilize it at much higher levels. Prior to the pandemic, they were going close to 60 a month for the 737 MAX. It can be done. Their job is to make sure it happens.
So what's the timeline here? When do you think, like year end, where would you like to see them?
So year end, what we've modeled at Bloomberg Intelligence is we think Boeing will be building 38 737s a month by 4Q, which should have been where they started this year out at 38. We think they were looking to break to 42 by the end of the year.
So do we ever get back to the 60? Should they ever get back to the 60?
Well, I mean, if you look at their competitor says they're shooting for 75 a month on the A320. So if their competitor is breaking to those kind of rates, when you break to higher rates on your primary narrow body, you have the opportunity to go out to your customers and non-customers, people that might be upset at Boeing, and sell more airplanes, right? Mm-hmm. So right now what we're seeing is, United has expressed an interest in A321s. Airbus is sort of constricted. Again, they've got, the backlog is full. There's airlines that want all those deliveries for the next number of years. We've seen JetBlue pop up and Spirit Airlines pop up and say, hey, we might be willing to give up some of our airplanes, or we are willing to give up some of our airplanes. We think that's a function of Airbus going out to those customers saying, we have another potential customer that would like A321s. Do you definitely want everything you've got in the books for the next couple of years?
How did we get, this might be a very silly question, but how did we get to the point where we got two airplane makers? And how does that make sense?
Well, this is not volume like automobiles, right? A good year in this business is a little bit over 1,000 airplanes a year, right? So it's not necessarily an industry that would support five or six manufacturers. Mm-hmm. With the right pricing and the right margins. And then you've got to put money into R&D and into development while you're, so you've got to earn a decent return so you can invest for the future. We did have more right in the U.S. We had Boeing, we had McDonnell Douglas, Lockheed used to build a commercial aircraft. But I think over time it slimmed down to where you could make them profitable. And at the same time, Airbus was growing in Europe because the Europeans wanted to be in this business, right? This is a good margin, strong manufacturing kind of industry, which really supports great jobs. They were rising, and that meant some of the U.S. manufacturers had to go away to create room for a European competitor. Mm-hmm. And what we have on the horizon someday, I think it's probably 5 or 6 years away at least, is the Chinese that want to be in the business. So either the pie has to grow even maybe 50% larger, or someone's got to dwindle in that whole thing, right?
Interesting. All right. When's the next boondoggle/air show that you're scheduled to go to?
Oh, yeah. You go to some fun ones, right?
I mean, and they're not in Cleveland in December.
No, they're not.
I just have to say, none of these are boondoggles. I work really hard. I'm exhausted when I come home.
All right. So what's the next one?
Farnborough Air Show.
Farnborough Air Show outside of London in July.
Yep.
What's the theme there? I mean, if I'm Boeing, can I even show my face there? I mean, what do I
–
I can't sell
right?
stuff. I mean, even if I make an announcement, I'm selling 200 planes to Emirates or something, I don't have the capacity to build them.
Yeah, so this year will be very interesting, right? Because I think, frankly, Airbus and Boeing don't have a lot more capacity right now. So I would expect the show would have a lot less sales. It's a sales show.
Yep.
Although on the wide body front, there's, I think, room to increase those build rates, especially for the Boeing 787 and the Airbus A350. They're two.
Are they separate factories? Do I build my 737 and my 787 in the same factory?
No, you build them in separate factories.
Okay, so I can ramp. Okay.
Yeah, and look, you have much lower volume on 787 builds at 6 a month, right? So going to 9 a month, you're not asking your suppliers to do a heck of a lot more, right? They're going 50% higher, but on very low volume. But so both of those manufacturers would like to increase the volume of those two airplanes, the 350 and 787, because mm-hmm. those would help them add to, you know, better margin, better cash flow. Right. At the rates they're at now, they're break-even-ish. They could get them into the high single digits, low double digits. I think if they got them up to 10 or so, they're on the road to do that. So I'd see this show being a wide-body sales show.
Okay, so that's sort of the Boeing Airbus story. Before we let you go, how is general demand? Like, we know from, say, Spirit, it's not great, but that might be a Spirit thing. But then you have the Delta, United, American. How are they doing?
No, it's great.
Everything's
demand
great?
Demand is great, but profitability isn't great.
So that means that feels like a problem.
Pricing might not be right. So, you know, what we're seeing, the tea leaves we're seeing is that it looks like premium demand is still pretty strong.
Tom Keene.
And that's going to help Tom Keene's premium. And that's going to help, you know, the big three, Delta, United, American, right? But the back of the bus, if you will, right, the back of the cheap seats, those are in much more supply and much more competitive right now. And so if you're an airline that focuses just on economy, I think you're going to have a harder time this earnings season than you will for the big three. The pilots are going to take a lot of the money away from the airlines this quarter. Really, the airline business is looking to us like there's a lot less business travel. Not a lot less. There's 10 or 20% less business travel, but it hurts because it's high priced travel.
Right.
So it looks like the business may make even more of its profitability in 2Q and 3Q. We're not expecting great things in 1Q from anybody, but again, the full service should do a little bit better. And what we're all watching is leisure summer demand going to be so strong that it's going to drive profits for the year, better profits for the year than they had last year? We feel like ticket prices might be softening. We'll get our first glimpses as airlines start to report and tell us what they're seeing for bookings.
Well, Alex and I have a major business trip for the month of June. It's going to be very impactful. So we'll be doing our... Did you get your tickets?
I got to do that.
Oh, yeah. You got to do that because, I mean, it's a big trip.
I work
big
in TV. We're like booking stuff like 3 days before. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I'm not like the long... Which is funny because I'm actually a long-term planner. George, good to see
you. Great to see
you,
too.
Thank you for coming in. We'll probably drag you over here tomorrow, too. Are you here tomorrow, too?
No.
2 days in a row, please.
I'm going to go back to Princeton. Sorry.
Yeah, all right. George
they have
Ferguson.
Lunch. They have everything there.
Exactly.
We have lunch. We get snacks.
Cows. No. We have real cows. Lunch.
Oh, okay.
Lunch
you.
Stations.
Proper lunch.
Yes.
Paul really wants to go to Princeton.
Farmer,
I do.
Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Aerospace Defense and Airlines Analyst George Ferguson joining us now. Always a pleasure.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes. 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
L'Occitane. Okay. Sorry.
It's all French. They have lavender scent. They have almonds. Anyway, my point being is that that's how we know it. It's the good hand cream place. And apparently, its billionaire owner is nearing a deal to take that skincare company private with funding help from Blackstone, and this is people familiar with the matter, ending its 14-year run on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. To be honest, I didn't even know it traded in Hong Kong.
Neither did I. I'm trying to look it up here, but I'm working on it.
So all right, he's working on it. He's going to work on it, and we're going to talk about it. Joining us now for more is David Havens, Bloomberg Intelligence, a senior credit analyst. He joins us. Okay, so do you use the hand cream?
I use the soap.
See? He uses the soap. See? It's good soap.
If they give it away at hotels.
Oh, yes. That's true. They do that. So is this Blackstone buying the company, or is this Blackstone being kind of like a banker to the billionaire and helping him buy it out?
It's the latter. So the way that the story reads thus far is that the billionaire owner is going to take the company private, or is making efforts to take the company private. Blackstone, I don't know if they will or won't. You know, it seems like the sort of thing that Blackstone might take a piece of the equity also for some of its funds. But I think the primary role that Blackstone will be playing here is providing the funding, the credit funding for the cash purchase.
So what's, it seems like Blackstone is everywhere these days. And granted, they are literally everywhere.
Yeah.
What are they doing in this marketplace? What are, is it kind of these deals here where they take a piece of the capital structure, whether it's equity or debt, or they do just big deals themselves? What are they up to these days?
Well, Blackstone is a $1 trillion alternative asset manager. It's the largest in the world. In the earlier segment, you talked about Blackstone's position in real estate. I believe they are the largest institutional investor in real estate, with over $300 billion of assets in their portfolio. They're gigantic in private equity, gigantic in private credit. They've got about $200 billion of dry powder that they need to put to work in order to earn fees on that money.
All right, so they've got that's a lot of deals.
Oh yeah.
I mean, where does that number typically? I got to figure that $200 billion of dry powder is probably more than they would like, because they don't necessarily get paid on that while it's just sitting there. They got to go out and spend it and then raise more, which is where they get paid.
Yeah, and just to put all that in context, I think that there's $2 to $3 trillion of dry powder across the private multiverse, I guess we can call it. But they're going to be looking everywhere globally, and they've got global reach. You know, that is pretty much not many compared to their global reach.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few in the ballpark, maybe.
Just going to the structure of the Lusitan deal for a sec. Is this unusual for Blackstone to provide the funding that like a bank would have normally done for the billionaire?
It's more and more common than it used to be, and I think that you can pretty much go back to the financial crisis. You can go back to bank regulations being rewritten in the aftermath of the financial crisis, with risk weight charges going up on corporate lending. So basically, one of the upshots of Basel III, Basel IV, Dodd-Frank, is that it's taken commercial banks, regional banks, out of sort of the traditional business of lending to corporations, particularly on a leverage basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so Blackstone, KKR, the whole universe of private credit is able to step into that breach on favorable funding costs without some of the regulatory overhang, and they're able to do pretty well right now.
All right, folks, on the bio page, if you want to get the bio of any guest we have, for example, you go bio and the name, and it's got career and education and all that kind of stuff. And it's also got a little section there called memberships, maybe where if you're, you know, board of directors or something like that, if you're a member of Council of Foreign Relations, you would list it there. David Havens, under memberships, includes Netflix and Sam's Wholesale Club.
Yeah. I love that you did that. That's awesome. That's really awesome.
I've got a few other memberships, too. But
exactly right. That's
very proud.
Very prestigious. You should be very, very proud. David, I'm surprised we haven't seen more private equity-backed IPOs. I mean, I got a market that's up 25% since October. Back when I was on the street, I could push out a gajillion deals with that kind of backdrop. Why are the private equity guys maybe not pushing? Are they worried about down round valuations? Or because I got to think it's been a fallow couple of years here for new deals. I would think they'd want to lock up or unlock some of these things.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. And I think that what's happened is you're going to see a lot more of these realizations, as they're called, you know, taking place. But we're only about a year off from the regional banking crisis in the U.S. and the failure of Credit Suisse. You know, so we saw some pretty significant tectonic temblers in the world of banking, and that I think put things on pause for a period of time. But I think that we're pretty much coming out of it. And if you look at equity valuations, the markets are obviously, you know, doing extremely well. It might be concentrated in a few names, but the market's generally doing well. And if you look at the credit market, The high-grade credit index in the U.S. is 86 basis points right now. Maybe 1% to 2% of the time over the past 20 or 30 years, it's been under 100 basis points. We're near record tight, 6 basis points away since 1999. So markets, I think, are ready and receptive. So it's just a case of, I think, getting these things prepped and ready to sort of send out the door. And they may not be IPOs. They might be sales to other private investors.
Right.
Right. Okay. Secondaries, right?
Yeah.
Like I feel like I've read a lot about how that's huge now, yeah, because the exit market has just not been around. Where do you think the issues and the cracks come in, whether you're looking at private equity or private credit? Because the narrative is like, look, it's 10-year investments. Okay, it's a tough few years, but it's going to be okay because we got like 7-5 more years to make it up, etc. But everybody says that, but then everyone warns about it. And I'm trying to understand who's going to be left holding the, I don't know, what are they holding? The bag, the empty bag, yeah, the non-Sam's Club bag?
Right. So I think that a year ago, there was an awful lot of concern that private credit would have serious problems. That hasn't occurred. If you look at the default rates within business development company portfolios, so these are public-private lenders that are part of, affiliated with Blackstone, KKR, companies like that, Ares. If you look at their performance, they've had virtually no defaults. So things haven't fallen apart. I think that what you're seeing is that there's an awful lot of cash out there left over from the pandemic. When you talk about risks going forward, monetary tightening is having, I guess, a negative influence in that there's less money supply out there, but it's just not showing up in terms of the performance of the companies right that have been lent to thus far.
What's the capital raising environment like for a lot of the funds you cover, both equity and for private credit? Can I go out there and just, is it still, I can go out there and pretty much raise any money if I'm a Blackstone or Apollo or KKR?
Yeah, if I have it right, I think that Blackstone raised $1.1 billion for BCRED, which is the largest business development company. It's got about $50 billion of assets, and it's a privately traded company. But I think they raised $1.1 billion in December or January, which I think was their biggest month ever. And if you look at BREIT, which is, I think, the largest REIT out there, they had a lot of redemption requests a year ago. Those redemption requests, I think, have dropped precipitously. So there's a lot of money out there that needs to find a home. And if you look at the total returns on private credit at Blackstone, for example, I think it was up 14% last year, which compares extremely well to just about anything else out there. So people are always chasing.
You're great. It's great. We love you.
Not his first
rodeo. What else are you watching?
Well, you know, I cover all sorts of financial thingamajigs that are not
that
non-bank thingamajigs. And one of the areas which I think is really interesting is what's going on between the private world, private debt, private credit, alternative asset management, and life insurance. And, you know, that's a $40 trillion addressable market, mm-hmm, for the alternative asset managers. You've seen companies like Apollo and KKR via Athene and Global Atlantic owning some of the top annuity and life insurance companies in the United States. So that's an area which I think we're going to see a lot more convergence over the next couple of years. And then you were talking in the earlier segment about office also, and about how real estate is not all created equal. Office is an area that we're going to continue to keep a very close eye on, because there is a real secular shift on top of what was a cyclical shift.
Yep.
Apartments, warehouses, you know, health properties, life sciences are,
yep,
are going
to be interesting to see where some of these big office properties trade in the urban centers, big discounts, I think. David Havens, thanks so much for joining us. David Havens, he's a senior credit analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We're waiting for CPI 8:30 tomorrow. Will it be a big market mover? And if not, what else are we waiting for? We're waiting then for earnings. They're going to kick off on Friday. So let's get the take now with Rubin Hovhannisyan. He's generalist portfolio manager over at TCW's Fixed Income Group. He joins us from Los Angeles, California. Rubin, what do you think the pain trade is into tomorrow's CPI?
Good morning. Thank you for having me on. Well, within the CPI tomorrow, well, the big pain trend is, as we've seen in the beginning of the year, we have seen, we may see some increase in CPI for driven by seasonal factors or driven by some other quirks of inflation calculation. But generally speaking, as we look at the inflation matrix, over a longer term, we see that the trend is one of declining or deceleration of inflation. So as we look at we got PCE about a week ago or so. The core PCE read was about 2.8% year over year. And while that's above the target that the Fed has, but that marks the 14th year over year decline in a row. And as we look at the core PCX shelter, as we know, shelter is one of the notorious lagging indicators of the inflation calculation. That was about 2.1%, much closer to the Fed's inflation expectation. And again, that marks more than a year of declining year-over-year rates of that measure.
All right. So, Ruben, I guess one of the first questions people have is like, what's this economy going to do? And what's this Federal Reserve going to do? It feels like the soft landing is being fairly well negotiated by the Federal Reserve, and that there's more than not, there will be some rate cuts this year. Do you guys agree with that?
We do agree with that. We do think that the rate cut, where we will see more rate cuts than what's currently being priced in. So generally, as we look at the market, we think that the market is being priced for perfection. You know, we have very, very gradual rate cuts priced in. You look at the credit markets, corporate credit markets, they are at cycle tights, spreads are at cycle tights right now, which means that the compensation that corporate bond investors receive for holding corporate bonds is at the lowest level we've seen in this cycle. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of optimism that's being priced into the market. We at TCW are less optimistic about the prospects of the economy. We think, in fact, that a lot of that optimism that we see in the market is perhaps extrapolation of the strong, resilient 2023 that we've seen. But we think that one should use a lot of caution when extrapolating from the strong, resilient 2023 mm-hmm. into 2024, because there were some significant tailwinds that helped growth in 2023 that we don't think are going to be nearly as powerful for 2024 growth. Enhanced the growth will probably, yes.
So what do you think, where will the data become weaker and where will we see that reflected? It seems like we can kind of pick the narrative and find the data, right? Like the NFIB, for example, lowest level since 2021, right? Expecting sales to fall. Like, it doesn't look great, but then you take a look at the jobs number and then it looks great.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The data has been coming in mixed, and you know, we had some very strong payroll data, but NFIB business optimism number this morning was not as good. Was actually pretty bad across the board. Whether you look at the credit condition for small businesses, whether you look at hiring plans, and if you do believe that the small businesses employ about 40% of your workforce, that's pretty significant. So we already see some cracks in the data. Some of the tailwinds that I talked about that were powerful in 2023 and perhaps the first quarter of 2024, as well as the data is coming in, helped prolong the cycle, so to speak. So, but we do still see cracks, especially in areas that are highly exposed to high, that are more interest rate sensitive. So when we look at on consumer side, for example, we look at the delinquency rates, and they are higher almost across the board. And in many, many cases, delinquency rates that we see are higher than pre-pandemic levels. As you remember, in 2023, the story was that delinquency rates are rising, but they're rising to pre-pandemic levels. So they're normalizing to pre-pandemic. That is no longer the case, because in many cases, especially at the for the bottom cohorts of income distribution spectrum, we do see that those delinquency rates are way higher than pre-pandemic levels and rising. When we look at the corporate sector, we do see that the segments that are most sensitive to interest rates bank loans that reset the rate on a quarterly basis, they see their default rates increasing. They went from sub 2% in a couple of years ago to mid-single digits, depending on how you measure, and there's right. Measure default. So they're on the rise as well. And we think that will continue as we see, you know, the monetary policy lags dissipate and monetary policy continue to weigh on the economic growth.
So, Ruben, I mean, I'm an equity guy, but I look at the two-year treasury and I can get 4.73%. Do I just park my money there or do I take some credit risk and think about that? How do you guys think about that?
Well, we do like the front end of the curve. So we're overweight duration and a big fraction of our overweight is in the front end of the curve in 2 years and 5 years, because we do think that's those are attractive rates. That being said, credit, we think, is very, very optimistically priced. We don't think investors get a ton of compensation for being in corporate credit. But we do think that the securitized markets, agency MBS, for instance, and some segments of non-agency securitized credit are very attractively priced. So we are currently expressing some overweights in those areas, as we think that those are more attractive, far more attractive than corporate credit, which is, as I mentioned, at cycle tights in IG and in high yield as well.
So if you like the front end, is that a pure yield play or is that a price appreciation play or honestly both?
Well, it's both. We do think we'll see some price appreciation. Yields are attractive, as we know, but we think that we'll get some price appreciation as well, because we do think that the rates will come down, especially more so in the front end of the curve. We do expect a bull steepening of the curve whereby the front end of the lower tenors, the shorter tenors will come down more than the belly and the long end of the curve. So we think you'll get both. You'll get a price appreciation and obviously you're clipping a very high yield while holding the short treasury bonds.
All right, Rubin, thanks very much. We really appreciate Rubin Hovhannissian. Okay, I'm going to get it. Hovhannissian. Did I get it? Did I sort of get it?
Yes, you did.
Nice. He's being so nice. Hovhannissian. All right, he joins us there. He's a generalist portfolio manager at TCW's Fixed Income Group.
You know those people, TCW, every person we get is like smart.
Super smart.
Super smart. I mean,
And, you know, you raised the point about, you're the equity guy.
Yep.
But the equity risk premium is like nothing over bonds, right? It's just like, how do you buy equities then when you can get a two-year yielding almost 5%?
I know.
And we talk a lot about how all that money in money market funds is going to go somewhere.
How about New Jersey municipal bonds?
Oh,
how about
dang.
That on a tax
deep
adjustment?
Tease for
it's
Friday.
It's only Tuesday, but I'm just getting you ready. Municipals on Friday. So,
yeah.
It's true.
I mean, slowly he'll convert me.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We strive to bring you the best from Bloomberg Intelligence. We cover 2,000 companies, 130 industries worldwide. We also strive to bring you the best from Bloomberg News. And to do that, we go to Sheridan Prasso. She's Bloomberg News Senior Investigations Writer, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Her story is the big take story on Bloomberg. She co-authored about how countries from Central Asia to South America are building their own killer tech based on Iranian designs. This does not feel like a feel-good story. Sheridan, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Walk us through what your story is about and what you learned in this investigation process.
Hi, so thanks for having me. We took a look at how U.S. technology flows are going into Iran's drone program, and what we found is just an incredible proliferation of Iranian drones now spreading throughout the world in ways that surprised even me from when I first started looking into this. You know, we obviously know about Iran's drone proliferation in the Middle East context, right, through Syria, Iraq, including now into Yemen, and then in the Middle East, you know, conflict in Gaza now as well. We're seeing kind of use of Iranian drones in the periphery of that conflict as well. But what also was surprising to us, we found, is that, you know, Iranian drones are now being manufactured in Russia. There's a program for 6,000 Iranian drones there that are starting to turn up now in the battlefields of Ukraine. They're increasing proliferation in places like Central Asia and in South America as well. So it really is quite an enormous spread around the world.
How is the technology, how advanced is the technology? Is this a model airplane with a lawnmower engine on the back, or are they going something further?
It essentially is. And really, it's fairly low tech, but what's been really successful about these programs is that they're increasingly developing them and learning from experiences on the battlefield, for example, in Ukraine. So what is now believed to be the case is that Iran learned from the way that Iranian drones were now being able to get into Ukraine, had increased their effectiveness in the Middle East context. So it's increasingly battlefield experience and more use of these drones that are allowing them to make more deadly strikes, actually, in these conflicts. We're seeing them, especially in the Red Sea. And also there was the particular case of the three servicemen who were killed in Jordan earlier this year. It was a fairly low-tech, small drone, but what it was able to do is, we learned in the course of this reporting, that it was kind of drafting in behind a U.S. drone that was attempting to land at the same time. And those drafting techniques are something that they've been working on improving in the Russian and Ukrainian context. So this kind of learning, growing, proliferating, using low-tech technology, mm-hmm. but actually improving its effectiveness is actually proving very deadly.
What can we do about this?
So the U.S. has export controls where we try to stop U.S. technology from going into these drones and into the manufacturing of these drones. The issue, though, is that Iran in particular has become a master of circumventing, you know, over 40 years of sanctions. There are very developed networks where front companies from all over the world are able to acquire this low-tech technology. A lot of our export controls are aimed at stopping sort of the higher-end, you know, chips now going to China, for example, for their AI. But in fact, the proliferation of kind of lower tech, you know, you need like maybe a few hundred low-tech chips, the kind that go into your, you know, lawnmower or your blender, any kind of regular household equipment, that low-tech stuff is actually what's powering the drones as well. And a lot of that is just available. It's recycled from old products. It's available from suppliers in Asia. China, in particular, has not been willing to enforce our U.S. export controls against Russia, for example. So there's actually a very big loophole, particularly in Asia, for U.S. tech flowing now into Russia, into Iran's drone program in Russia. So there are a bunch of concerted efforts now to try to make that stop.
Sheridan, do we know how effective these drones are?
So they've been very deadly in particular instances. What we've seen is a halt to, I forget the percentage, maybe more than 50% of shipping in the Red Sea has been halted by some drone attacks in the past few months. We've saw the deadly attack in Lebanon and several other very effective drone strikes as well. And so it's really cause for alarm in Washington. You know, we're wondering how far this is going to go, how effective this is, our efforts at stopping it are going to be. You know, we're considering kind of how do you actually get U.S. companies to stop allowing their technology to go there. And the companies that we talk to, for example, Texas Instruments, Analog Devices, a lot of their stuff, at least 80% of the drones that are turning up in Ukraine are containing this U.S. technology from, in particular, these companies and a few others as well. How do you get that to stop and therefore decrease Iran's ability to proliferate? And that's the biggest question now.
What did those companies say?
The companies say that we abide by U.S. export controls. We have insisted our suppliers do so as well. The issue is that there's so many loopholes. And in particular, Hong Kong is proving to be a very difficult place. It used to be maybe 10, 12, 15 years ago, we had much better relations with Hong Kong. They would have been a lot closer to Western interests. And now with the changes that have happened in Hong Kong in the last 3-4 years, we have seen less willingness on the part of Hong Kong officials to actually enforce U.S. export controls, particularly going towards Russia. And so we've seen a big uptick in proliferation from equipment going via Hong Kong into Russia, for example. It is much better, though, at enforcing UN sanctions against Iran, and so it has successfully stopped a lot of technology going to Iran, but still there are quite a few kind of leaks in the dam, basically. So it's happening all around.
All right, Sheridan, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. Sheridan Prasso, Bloomberg News Senior Investigations writer, and I highly recommend that everyone read her piece. You can find the story on Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/Big Take. Check out the Bloomberg Big Take podcast at Bloomberg.com and wherever you get your podcast. I love how do you get turned on to all these stories, right? Because you're an investigative reporter, it can go in so many different directions. But what an amazing piece of work, and something that isn't... We're working on it. That's not like an easy, quick fix.
No. And on this story, there is the Big Take podcast co-hosted by David Gura, mm-hmm. And they're featuring this story. So you can go check out that podcast. Just fascinating stuff.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
A lot of folks are saying, you know, as I look at the market here off a half of 1%, as John was just reporting, that what this market needs is a bigger pullback, maybe 5%, 10%, something like that, that would not be the worst thing for this market. But we have not seen that in some time. Again, S&P up more than 25% off of those October lows. Let's check in with a professional now. Nancy Daoud, she is private wealth advisor at Ameriprise Financial, joining us from Miami, Florida via Zoom. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us here. I mean, what are you telling your clients here? Is it just up and away here for risk assets?
Well, that's a great question because, everybody wants to talk about how great the market is. And what we're really telling our clients is essentially to be very, very cautious because people get too used to this and they expect it to just continue forever. And up markets don't last and neither do down markets, obviously. And I think this is the opportunity for us to sit down with our clients and talk about, well, what are your shorter term cash needs? Because there's no better time to just take some money off the table and hoard it for those immediate cash needs, anything in the next 1 to 3 years. This is the time to do it. And I believe also that that's probably what we're seeing. I mean, we saw a couple of days of downturns in the last week. And of course, now that's happening again. I think a good chunk of that could very well be some profit taking.
Yeah, absolutely. But we just, a lot of folks, again, expect to see more pronounced profit taking than what we've seen recently. And one of the issues is, for by and large, this is a market really in 2023 and continuing to some degree this year has really been led by those big tech names. I know there's some laggards like Apple, like Tesla, but the big tech names have still been kind of leading the way. Is that still going to be the case? Do you think tech is still the leader in this market?
Well, longer term, certainly yes. But just more recently, it's been nice to see a broadening of the market a little bit. We've seen financials do really well. Healthcare continues to do well. Energy, obviously, is catching up a bit, and mostly because of the geopolitical environment that we're in. And we're seeing a little bit of the broadening of the market, which helps in that sentiment a little bit. You'd never want just one sector to dominate, you know, to make or break the market. But longer term, certainly technology is the next boom, or the AI really is the next boom. And if you're in it for the longer term, meaning 7 to 10 years or longer, what an opportunity.
Do you feel in the shorter term, do you feel confident that the broadening out will continue throughout this earnings season?
Well, you know, I think there's quite a few variables that may or may not affect that. And that's the persistent inflation. I mean, getting to 2%, I think, is going to be a lot tougher than everyone thinks, because the progression or the progress that we've made in the last couple of years has been, you know, pretty much on track. But it's always that home stretch that takes a little longer and with a significant more effort. I know everybody's been very bullish about rate cuts happening, you know, next month, or we don't believe that that's going to happen anytime soon. And if it does, it won't be until the latter part of the year. I mean, we're seeing mortgage rates actually going up at this time. And the reality is sinking in, you know, and that is that although inflation is no longer increasing or going up as much, you know, this is the new normal. Prices are the way they are now. They are not going back. And there's a little bit of an adjustment to that.
Yeah. Hey, Nancy, my co-host here, Alex, is a expert in the field of all things energy. What do you think about that sector right now with Brent crude at, you know, close to $90 a barrel?
Well, typically we always see energy as an opportunity during a time of geopolitical risk, which we certainly have right now. So since October, when the Middle East war started, then we began to buy some energy or ETFs mainly. And that's when we saw a big uptick, but then it kind of came down. Now it's really going up again. So this is, you know, oil prices are always something to watch during a time when there's a lot of geopolitical risk. And we have a war in Europe, and we have some stuff going on in Southeast Asia. I mean, it's on every front.
So based on that, I mean, I appreciate that the oil trade is there for that. Do you think the gold is moving along the same lines as that, or do you think gold's moving on its own? Because no one kind of really gets what's going on there.
Well, that's hard to predict, but it doesn't appear that they're moving together. I think they're probably kind of on its own. Gold is probably on its own a bit.
Yeah, but it's interesting when we talk about safe havens, Paul, right?
Like, yeah.
Is that what's happening? Okay, we're going to play stuff, but we're going to go safe haven as gold, or is it something...
Yeah, and you know, the central banks, we had a guest this morning, Tom Keene and I, and really talking about the central banks around the world kind of concerted buying there, including China. Nancy, just lastly, real quick, what are you looking for in earnings? We're going to get earnings kicking off in earnest this week here.
Well, we're expecting to see more of the same. It wouldn't be unusual to see a little bit of some pullback, or you know, not maybe not as strong. But, you know, it's interesting that it's always about expectations. If we expect earnings to be really strong and they come up weaker, the market reacts violently. And if earnings are expected to be weak and they come out really strong, the market, reacts violently also. Mm-hmm. So it really all has to do with expectations, not so much about the real numbers. And, you know, when we put together portfolios and make recommendations for clients, it's really about the math, not about sentiment. You've got to always go back to the math, because the math always rules in the end.
Yep. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us. Nancy Daoud, president. She's a private wealth advisor at Ameriprise Financial.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.